Dialogue Conspiracy Program. Hello there, everybody.
We made
Can I steal something from Abe Mellencamp?
Yeah, go
it's
ahead.
It's entitled
read it.
The Morning Report. Morning Report. Colon. A lot of the joy of the election was squeezed away by the experts. It was a nifty double development. This is how it worked. The pollsters told us how we were going to vote long before Election Day, and the TV networks told us how we voted before the ballots were counted. Together, this adds up to making the voter himself obsolete, and minor legal steps should be taken at once to eliminate elections. Polls would be taken every 4 years, and the winning candidate would be photographed thanking a room full of humming computers. The loser could repeat after the event what he always says before, the polls are wrong. But the polls and the networks are right. Instead of spending millions on spot announcements, campaign managers would serve their candidates better by just switching the circuits on key computers.
Well, how about that? The election's over, and we made it. We've survived a couple of days, almost a week.
Almost a week.
Almost a week.
I wouldn't say almost a week. Not quite a week. It's just been a few days, really.
I really dreaded the 1972 elections. For a whole year, I felt like I was working against time, that they should be stopped and should not proceed. And then when the Watergate thing broke, I was convinced that people would see this second government and the espionage trickery that had been played on the electorate and speak up and proclaim that they had been taken advantage of, the Democratic Party. But nothing happened.
Well, they didn't do it, did they?
No, nobody seem to get that outraged. The Democrats don't seem to care that much about the espionage that's taken place to their party. The party's completely broken in shambles, and they sort of look to themselves to what's wrong. They don't look at the outside, that it could have been destroyed from the outside.
Ah, but we do have a trial starting. You think that's going to mean anything? The Watergate trial is due to begin next week, is it not?
Well, the I don't think Nixon's going to have as much fun the next 4 years as he had before, because a lot of the secrets of the way he operates and manipulates are exposed. But the trials could turn out to be absolutely nothing, because seven men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, and seven were found there and seven were arrested. And the men that received the information that they were taking when they were bugging are not arrested. The men that paid them to do the job are not arrested. So it's just going to be a very limited trial, unless they bring in more people anyway. They're not naming the persons that they were doing it for, just the people that were caught. So
you don't think there's much to look forward to in the trial?
Well, Richard Nixon controls the Justice Department so totally and the investigative agencies, and he's building up Patrick Gray to be the new head of the FBI, and with the image that he allows mustaches and colored shirts and no wiretapping, you know, on congressmen. You don't need it. Now the government is tightly controlled. You don't have to follow these people. They're not even speaking up. There's nothing to listen to anymore. He has the situation well in hand, from what I can see. You know, when it was over, I almost thought everyone deserved Richard Nixon. You know, the people that could have done more didn't do it to get him out. Where they really cared, like on some of these initiatives, and like the farm labor of the coast, they could swing that difference in the votes. And if they really didn't want Nixon, they could have done more. And if they wanted him, they got him. So either way, I'm accepting it, just without getting too excited or angry, because the frustration of not being exposed to the way the Republican Party has acted for the last 20 years would have been terrible, because the evidence of the conspiracies, the manipulation, has been available to various researchers. But when it was open to the public and people couldn't pick it up, then I began to think, well, maybe Richard Nixon's what they really want.
You think the whole concept of there being a grand master scheme that's quote-unquote bigger than all of us is just too much for the average American to handle?
Oh, yes. James Reston had an article in the New York Times this week that went into all the newspapers around the country. It was in the San Jose Mercury and the San Francisco Chronicle and the Monterey Herald. And he refers to the election as a writer's dream. And he goes into the drama of this particular election, and then he thinks maybe it was done so William White could write another book on the making of the president. But in this article that he had, he said no sensible book publisher would have risked much money a couple of years ago on a political novel so fantastic. He goes in with the death and the tragedy at the Bridge of Chappaquiddick and Edward Kennedy, the main hope of the Democratic Party and the logical successor, being unable to run this year. And he talks about the two murdered brothers. And then he goes to the tragedy of George Wallace, who was taken out of the race just when he was beginning to make progress in the North and hold the balance of power between the two major parties. And he goes into the Eagledon affair, which this week there was some suggestion that the FBI knew all along of Mr. Eagledon's problems and that a Republican had informed Jack Anderson about the drinking thing, and it seemed like a trap that caught McGovern right off the bat. It goes into the hanky-panky of the Republican money. He calls it hanky-panky, this dangerous espionage, with the Republican dollars and the grain milk deals, the burglary. And then he says Martha Mitchell was attacked and drugged by her own security agents and forced her husband, the head of the committee, to reelect the president to retire. And James Reston says the only possible explanation of all this, it must have been arranged by Teddy White as material for another novel. A scenario for a reasonable presidential campaign, it makes no sense at all. And then James Reston went on to say that in 1962, when Richard Nixon lost the race for governor in California to Pat Brown, he sat at the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Suite 724 with Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Finch, Klein, Ziegler. And he said those are the people that are with him now in the White House. And at that time, they were complaining about the press and the Democrats. And again, this year, they are. And at the beginning of his career, with a Checkers speech and his secret campaign fund, he proclaimed his innocence. And now he has this huge campaign fund, and one of his daughters is married to Eisenhower's grandson. And James Reston passes all this off as just a story that is... is a novelist's dream. And I think that if you take everything he's saying and hold it side by side to the article I did in The Realist or my 9 years research, I don't take any of these things as being coincidental and unrelated. And I think, I've said over again, they all had to do with getting Richard Nixon into power, and it was a brilliant play. And the proof of what I'm saying could be laid out in front of people by just opening the National Archives, for example. And we talked about that last week. A new suit came up to open the National Archives to get the evidence on certain matters, John Kennedy's autopsy and his clothing and different items that Earl Warren, who was Chief Justice, said we can't have for 75 years. There's all kinds of evidence that would prove that these events were planned and not unrelated.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned a moment ago George Wallace and the shooting incident which took him out of the campaign. The observation was made during the election that the votes that Richard Nixon had, the percentages that Nixon had during this 72 election, resembled the vote that he had in 1968 plus Wallace's votes.
Yes.
Now, you indicate that you agree with that, and then the question is, then, would that... do you think support your theory that Richard Nixon had something to do with the Wallace?
Well, I feel very strongly that the evidence lines up that he certainly did have, and I'd be like to prove him wrong.
But you do find something significant in the figures, the Wallace plus Nixon figures from 68 equaling roughly the... Did you find that to be true?
Well, I felt that Nixon needed those Wallace votes in Maryland. To take all the southern states, he needed the Wallace votes so it wouldn't be split. And that cinched his getting a lot of areas, Maryland and Michigan and the South. And with Wallace out of the race, Nixon was sure of a victory. He wasn't sure as long as there were other candidates in. He heavily financed the McGovern thing to get him in because he knew that he was a candidate easiest to beat. He needed the southern votes. There was a story in the Washington Post. They're running a series of biographies of men involved in the Watergate affair in the White House, and there was one on Fred LaRue. And this is a very interesting story about Fred LaRue and his relationship to Richard Nixon. He's a man that works in the White House And until he went over to the committee to reelect Richard Nixon, that is on no White House books, receives no salary, and his background is very interesting. And it has to do with Wallace, too, because Fred LaRue is the man who is the architect or works as the Southern strategy man and plan how to get the Wallace votes to Richard Nixon without the North knowing that he was doing it.
And what was his plan?
Well, his plan was to work with the Wallace people, but to keep them, to get them to sign over to Richard Nixon, but not to let the North know that they were taking these votes away. They wanted Nixon to look liberal in the North, but they wanted him to look strong in the South. And the Washington Post says that LaRue helped woo Wallace votes to Nixon in 1968, and then was keeping the Southern strategy alive and kicking. He meddled in the campaigns of Senator Eastland, and his father was a good friend of Eastland's. He's an oil millionaire, this Fred LaRue. Fred LaRue was mentioned by Baldwin at the time. He turned informer. He was the man who received the information from the Watergate across at the Howard Johnson Hotel. And he spoke up and told how he was assigned. Baldwin said LaRue took Martha Mitchell on sensitive trips, and that he had a weapon that he handed Baldwin to use that was not registered, but he said, just say, this is my weapon, and you work for John Mitchell and the committee to reelect Richard Nixon. Well, LaRue is very important in the White House, and he's very high up in the category. He's John Mitchell's right-hand man, and when Mitchell isn't around, LaRue speaks for him. But he has no post in the White House, and he's not registered. And when he was mentioned in terms with the Watergate espionage, the men working at the White House, a lot of them didn't know who he was even. There's no pictures of him. And all his biography says was rank, serial number, and so forth. Nothing about him. But the Washington Post did an interesting story on him. He's a very wealthy oil man from Mississippi, close friend of Eastland's, an intimate friend of his. Got a degree in geology in 1951, and he has friends. He finances campaigns on both sides, Republican or Democrats, without any legislation on oil or gas, because they have a lot of gas and oil in Mississippi. His investments, they can control those decisions. LaRue owned a casino in Las Vegas, and before, in 1963, he bought a small hotel and a casino in Las Vegas, which he sold in 64. Now, that was the period where Jack Ruby was going back and forth to Vegas, too, in 63. And there was a story about him done in Long Island Newsday where Fred LaRue's name never appeared on the lease. He bought a hotel called The Castaway, but his name wasn't there again. He's a very mysterious man who people didn't know at all, although he held a very important position in the White House. Another thing about LaRue was that he has a very close-knit family. Mother and sisters, they live on a compound with a tennis court and many homes around it, $100,000 each.
But there's nothing illegal about that.
No, there's nothing illegal. It was a widowed mother, but the question, his father died in a hunting accident in which LaRue had killed his father in 1957. This is John Mitchell's right-hand man in the White House, and they didn't know. There was a lot of mystery involved. The mother and the brother and sister and Fred live very tightly, close together, don't see anybody, and the sister Ruth says she doesn't know the details of the accident. She said it was one of those unavoidable things. Fred killed his father accidentally in 1957, and he's riding planes with Martha Mitchell and handing a weapon that isn't registered to Mr. Alfred Baldwin. He's had enough experiences with weapons, I should think. Baldwin at the time didn't know why LaRue handled a weapon, because he wasn't in security work. The biography of LaRue is very interesting. Goldwater, he worked for Goldwater in 1963 to 1968. 1964, he worked for Barry Goldwater. And Barry Goldwater doesn't know how LaRue met John Mitchell. One is from Mississippi, the other is from a lawyer for Rockefeller in New York. And this is that clandestine connection, again, of how these people meet, that he takes over in the White House for Mitchell, his right-hand man, and very powerful man in Washington. But
so how would you...
the Wallace thing, his job in the South was to take care of the Southern votes. The Washington Post said LaRue helped woo Wallace votes to Nixon in 68 to keep the Southern strategy going. He meddled in campaigns of other people to make them lose. He had important connections with Eastland, who protected the Justice Department from going into the ITT case. And LaRue's Southern strategy being a Mississippi man, he worked hard to get the Southern votes. He worked with Kleinitz, Mitchell, and they kept the Southern votes for Richard Nixon and all the time kept the North pacified. That was the role that he had, to not let the North know how much they sympathized with the Wallace votes. He was working hard to get the Wallace votes to Nixon and take them away. This is when Wallace was still alive. Now, there was another article this week on in L.A. Free Press of the American Nazi Party claiming the Republicans paid them, this is John Mitchell again, meeting with Jeb Magruder of the White House, to take their votes away from the Wallace Party, the American Independent Party. They paid the American Nazi Party to, and worked with them and met at a hotel with them, that John Mitchell did with Jeb Magruder in November of 1971 at the Hilton Hotel. They met with the American Independent Party to take the votes away from Wallace. So, you know...
The Nazis?
American Nazi Party.
Met with the American Independent Party?
No, the Nazi Party met with Jeb Magruder and John Mitchell to tell them not to line up in the voter registration with the American Independent Party. They should be Republicans.
John Mitchell?
Yes, John Mitchell with the American Nazi Party.
Why would... The American Nazi Party is not that strong in America that would justify having the Attorney General of the United States meet with them.
Well, the article that I have here is written by Alan Zack, and Mary Beth says that they targeted for subversion against the right-wing American Independent Party, that the committee to reelect Richard Nixon didn't only go against the Democrats, that they met at the Hotel Hilton in November 71, and their outline was to get the American Independent Party off the California ballot and get them all registered Republican Party. They kept saying, we have to get California because Nixon's sensitive about California. It said, the committee to reelect the president was concerned about Nixon's chances in California. If Wallace were not on the ballot, 4 out of 5 of his supporters would go Nixon. Now that was planned a year ago, that they were what to do with Wallace. It makes you wonder. It really does when you see how the poll came in and what happened to Wallace. And the way Bremer was treated and the amount of money Arthur Bremer had, you see, and his mobility and airplane tickets and his sentences being reduced. Bremer had contacts, and I was hoping always that the election would be put off some way until we'd find out if Wallace was shot in order for Richard Nixon to have those votes. But the election's over, and I don't even know how much can be done to talk about dialogue conspiracy after the election. I wondered about it, Phil, if there's much point in talking about it. You're talking about an administration that's in power now for the rest of time, and to say...
What do you mean the rest of time? Well, I don't think... 4 years.
No, and then there's Mr. Agnew that's going to come along. There's the way they took over the Democratic Party and the media... There's no way that they can be uprooted, I don't think, now.
Do you think that, looking ahead to 76, that Ted Kennedy will overcome Chappaquiddick?
No. No, he's chasing around with somebody already. They're getting the goods on him. He's got another girlfriend. And, you know, I don't think he wants to be president. He's going around.
Don't just drop that one.
What?
What do you mean he's going around with he's got another girlfriend?
Haley... of Columbia Broadcasting, his daughter, I forget her name, they have allegedly been meeting, and it's been written up in the newspapers and the gossip columns, and he's got this girlfriend that he's been seeing or traveling with or associated with, and certainly indiscreet in the fact that it's written up in many places, and in the Chronicle and Women's where the New York, the Daily, and I see a lot of the newspaper articles mentioning company of this particular person, and I don't think he wants to be president after what happened to his two brothers, and the older brother died before he had a chance to become president. The father wanted him to be. So I think Ted, his behavior will be such that he'll continue acting the way he did before. I just don't think he's presidential material.
Yet the talk around, even before this election was over, was, we'll wait till 76, it'll be Kennedy Agnew.
Well, that's a lot of talk. In order to be presidential material, you have to act like, you know, you have to behave yourself. So see, the things that he does, you'd never get Agnew or Richard Nixon on. You know, they just don't wander around that way. And so if you want to come down on them, it would be easy to defeat him at any time just based on his past record. I don't see how he could. The Democrats may want him, but there'd be such a smear campaign. And I don't know that he's presidential material. But this is just a build-up.
Do you see anyone emerging as a viable challenger to Agnew?
Oh, you mean
Are we fated to, from the Democratic standpoint, fated to 8 more years, not just 4 more years of Republican administration?
Well, my definition of what is presidential timber is different than a lot of people's. There's a certain honesty or concern about life, the life of individuals, public figures, and students being killed, civil rights leaders being killed, and we're going on now to the subject of a member of our local community being killed. And if the politicians don't speak up and care about that, if they just speak in platitudes like the war or the economy, then I just don't think it matters who's there because they're just throwing around a lot of words. I see very few people. I can't think of who has the courage. The people that have the courage get killed. You know, the ones that speak up about certain situations get killed. In fact, most of the program today, I didn't even want to talk about elections. I wanted to talk about a somber subject, about death, because in our own local community, a member of our local community was killed, shot last week and died on Sunday of this last week, and that was Brady Avery. And I thought I'd talk about his death and what it means in terms of what he was trying to do, and for the remaining of the show, just read off the other people that were killed like him, whose deaths are very suspicious, that are unsolved, and go into the possibility of, are these things conspiracies? How do you separate a simple family quarrel from a planned conspiracy? How do you know where one begins and the other ends, and when does the information come in? Is everything a conspiracy? Is every death a conspiracy? Or can a family, a particular family, just have a fight and one member shoot the other, such as in the family of Brady? But Brady was a 49-year-old businessman in Seaside. Did you have him on the show? Did you know him, Phil?
I had interviewed him several times.
Yeah.
Had met him at the People's Parts House in Seaside.
Well, Brady had a car repair shop in Sand City, which was predominantly all white, and he and his partner are black, and they were hassled, and they wanted to remove the blacks from this particular location. This is what Brady thought was happening. And he had a recall suit out in Sand City because his livelihood was stopped. And he went to court, and he used the court and the legal system. He worked within the system. He became more radical as each day went on. But he tried to work within the system to see if you can't get a break or get a fair shake. Brady's political background at the time of his death, he was a member of the Third World Movement, Black Liberation Movement, a candidate for peace and freedom for Assemblyman. He ran against Bob Wood, and he ran for the Seaside City Council. And Brady had his suit, and Francis Heisler, attorney in town, took the suit to the court that went up to San Jose, the higher court, and he won a $42,000 suit in his favor. Because of the harassment and the moving of his business out of the Seaside location and the Sand City location. And in the suit, he named Philip Calabrese, the mayor of Sand City, and other members of the city council and the chief of police in Sand City. And Brady stood up for what he believed was right. He was hassled by the police and chased around and given a really hard time in Sand City and Seaside, but he took this thing to the court and was awarded the $42,000, which really seemed too good to be true.
Yeah, no, that's what Brady claimed, and that's what the jury agreed with.
Yeah, on November, it was a jury, on November 8th, 1971, he, in front of U.S. District Judge Peckham, he won $42,000. Now, instead of being paid this amount of money, the judge who said that he had won the suit, stated 2 weeks before his death, this is 2 weeks ago, that they'd have a retrial on the suit. And what does that mean? That means that Brady has to give up his work and go up to San Jose, and the lawyer has to give his time, and it costs thousands of dollars to retry a thing which 2 years ago he won and never received the money. It's expensive to go back and forth. And 2 weeks before he was killed, they told him to get a settlement for $3,000 or have a retrial. Where for a poor man working, making a day-to-day expense, it's very difficult to retrial. It's difficult to go to court in the first place, but to go up there, it's almost impossible. So Brady, he had to make that decision, and here was $42,000 sitting out there, and now Brady is killed. And will there be a retrial? Will his family get that money? What happens to him? Well, was Brady murdered because certain elements in Seaside thought that he was a thorn in their side? Was he controversial? What was he doing? The military men in Fort Ord, around the area, the black radical, he was the most outspoken, the only actually black radical in the Seaside area. And it's significant to talk about him because the only one who was standing up for certain privileges that should be his as an American citizen, and he was shot in the back. And the circumstances of his being shot were that he had a fight with his son-in-law. And the son-in-law went in the other room and got out a 20-gauge shotgun and shot him in the back and just blew his intestines out the front and blew off his arm. Shot him twice in the arm and in the back with this terrible weapon.
This is coming from who?
Well,
since the thing is going to go to trial, I'm going to be careful with what we say.
Well, this is the actual fact. He had the shotgun, and Brady was shot twice. And
that much has been reported by the news media.
Yeah, and then he died. And the important thing about this case is that Brady, I don't want anything to affect the trial, but Brady was a controversial person in his community because he was speaking up for certain things that he believed were his right to earn a living in that particular community, to not be chased around by the police. He took the thing to court, and very conveniently, by his being dead, he probably, unless they can raise a lot of money, won't get back to have a retrial with him deceased, his partner still alive. If people want to send contributions to KLRB towards that trial, there was an article in the Herald this week that Francis Heisler will take the trial. And at Brady's funeral this week, it was suggested that they fight for this trial. That this is a racist, one-sided world where when you win a trial, you can't even win it. You lose in death. And if money is raised, I believe Francis Heisler will proceed to retry that case for the heirs of Brady Avery. And I think he won that through a jury trial, a fair trial, and just 2 weeks before he was killed. They said, you know, go back for retrial. And something is really unfair about that. And I think about it because the last time I saw Brady, he had listened to some shows on KLRB, and he was getting a little more interested in dialogue conspiracy because he felt that he wasn't going to live very long. And this was just about 2 months ago. And he and Shelley were at my home, and we were talking, and he wanted to know the pattern of conspiracies. Who are all these people? You know, it's always one side that's being killed, and I'm going to bring in, you know, I brought in some of the people to mention.
Okay, let's get to those in a minute after we take time out to break the station and take a short break. You're listening to Dialogue Conspiracy on 24-Hour KLRB FM, Carmel.